then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's January the 15th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
Hey, everybody. This is Andy Donner. No segment this week. Sorry, my day job has me pretty busy. However, I do need to bust into the program to deal with something very specific. In the recent past, think this year, we've been contacted by a number of people in the Puget Sound area and surrounding counties. Unfortunately, we seem to have let most of them slip through the cracks. We're sorry. This is our fault. We dropped the ball. I know this looks sloppy, but please bear in mind it's best for security and safety reasons that we actually don't keep a whole lot of tracking process or paperwork on initial contacts. But that doesn't matter to you because we let you slip through the cracks. Again, I'm sorry. We'll do better next time. Whether you got a hold of us through the message board or email or whatever, would you please try again? Thank you.
Okay, I will get back to the T-shirt youth question I raised last week later on in this podcast, but first, a few quick housekeeping notes. Now, I really, really, really don't like using this show to communicate with individuals, but sometimes I have no choice. First off, some of our Oregon comrades may remember Brian S., the guy whose wedding we attended a few years ago. Now, I know he's married now and he's got a child, maybe even more than one now, and he made it clear to me at the time that now he had responsibilities, he wouldn't be taking as much of an active role with the party, which I totally got, no problem. But I need for Brian S. to get in touch with me now. His old email is good, apparently. He's always been on the email list, and it's not bouncing back, so at least he does still check it on occasion. But this is a wee bit time-sensitive, so Brian, if you are listening, please get in touch. Email me. Do not attempt to call. If any of our Portland folks have kept up with Brian, not the other Brian we all know, but Brian S. from a few years ago, if any of you can get in touch with him, please let him know that I need to speak to him. Now, I would like to address the gentleman using the name Marcus, who was so kind as to write me a 4-page, single-spaced, soul-outpouring letter a few weeks ago. Marcus, I have repeatedly attempted to use the email that you gave me, and I'm sure I typed it correctly, but it keeps getting bounced back. Now, this may have something to do with Hushmail, which is supposed to be secure, but which is instead merely a pain in the ass. For some reason, I have a lot of trouble with Hushmail. I have some Hushmail email addresses on the list, and some work, but I have constant problems even with those getting bounced back every fourth or fifth time. Also, while we're on the topic, the guy using the name Andrew, your support for the Northwest Republic is deeply appreciated, comrade, and thank you. But your Hushmail address doesn't function about half the time, and you seem to be missing at least half of your Northwest Revolution emails. They're bouncing back. Any chance at all of a more accessible email address? It's a real pity to leave a good supporter like yourself half in the dark. Now, getting back to Marcus, I need you to contact me again at nwnet@earthlink.net. That's N-W-N-E-T at earthlink.net. And give me a usable email address that doesn't bounce. Gmail is always nice, or some other web-based email that doesn't use whatever weird cyber stuff Hushmail uses in the illusory name of security, and which makes it impossible to communicate because your email bounces back. Now, I will also need a name and a mailing address for your introductory packet of literature, which will include a white book. That does not have to be your right name, and a post office box or a drop box is fine, but it has to be a name and address to which the post office will deliver mail. I'm presuming that you're sincere and not some kind of really weird troll, since you took the time to type out a 4-page, single-spaced, soul-pouring-out letter. But a 4-page, single-spaced, soul-pouring-out letter is no good without some kind of contact address for follow-up. People, if you want to get in touch with a party, then get in touch with a party. If you have reached that point in your personal and political journey, the FBI and the NSA already know who you are. Before reaching the point where you are sufficiently radicalized and ready for the Northwest Front, you will have blundered down a whole series of dead ends, maybe starting with a Tea Party, in which case the IRS has your name. Anyway, these dead ends will have brought you to the attention of the secret police as someone whose mind is not fully under control. If you have ever used a forbidden word in an email, their packet-sniffing and word recognition software picked up on it and flagged that email in the vast archive databases they maintain in Utah and West Virginia. If you have ever logged in to Stormfront or VNN, never mind posted on it, your IP address has been noted and your physical location probably automatically tracked down by the NSA's various programs, and your physical location has been recorded and added to your file. If you have ever joined or posted to Stormfront, VNN, eNationalist, or any other racial V bulletin boards, your IP address has damn sure been recorded and your name and location cataloged. Now, since this is the 21st century, and with the best will in the world, it is now simply impossible to avoid leaving some kind of electronic footprint, they know who you are already. So quite frankly, using hush mail that clashes with my own email for some reason and sends half the emails bouncing back does nothing to protect you and just annoys the hell out of me. I will say this yet again. White nationalists cannot hide from our enemies. We can only confuse and hide from our friends. Next up, a lot of people have said that they want me to comment on the Muslim attacks against the Jews in France, including an attack on the offices of a so-called satirical magazine, and the shooting of some cartoonists, several of whom were Jews, and also shooting up a kosher deli in Paris. Okay, I'd sit down and think about this one for a while, especially the whole issue of whether I was going to comment at all on it. Right now, I'd say not, but I will comment on why I won't comment. First off, while in theory the Constitution of the United States is still in force, including the First Amendment, guaranteeing free speech, in practice we all know that it's not, and that any freedom of speech or thought or conscience we enjoy is allowed to us on the sufferance of the regime. If the regime is sufficiently displeased with something that I or anyone else says, then it will use force to punish that person and make him be quiet. In some cases, such as that of Edgar J. Steele and Jeff Hughes, this goes as far as murder. And now, possibly, Bill White as well, who, at the time I'm making this, has been completely incommunicado for a month, which is, of course, completely illegal, but Bureau of Prisons doesn't have to obey the law, and he may be dead or extraordinarily rendered out of the country, we just don't know. My genuine opinion on what happened in France is not something that the dictatorship wants to hear, and more importantly, it's not something that the dictatorship wants you to hear, because there's always the chance that at some point people might actually start to listen to what I have to say. And by listen, I don't mean just sitting there and absorbing it like a sponge and then tuning in again next week to sit and absorb some more. By listening to me, I mean acting on what I have to tell you. And that possibility scares these people shitless, because they know something that you don't, and that is that this white separatism thing, this Northwest Republic thing, might actually work if somehow I can ever get you people to listen. They can't take that chance, and although I don't pretend to understand how the minds of FBI agents or government attorneys or bureaucrats work, I do have the distinct impression that in their worm-eaten minds, they've drawn a set of lines that I'm not allowed to cross, and I have a suspicion that stating my genuine opinion on what happened in Paris last week might cross those lines. Now, I know that eventually, inevitably, possibly deliberately, possibly unintentionally, I'm going to cross those lines. So what I have to decide is, do I want to do so now? Is now the time to take on any potential bullshit that might come down from on high via the dictator's servants if I exercise my First Amendment rights and I clearly and openly state my true opinion on what happened in Paris last week? Am I ready to deal with whatever happy, crappy results from my daring to utter aloud thoughts which I have been forbidden to think by them as is so much better than me? I have to juggle these things in my mind. I have to speculate. What would happen this time if I really did say what I think out loud? Would I just be ratcheted up another few surveillance points or threat level points or however the Bureau rates us wicked evil terrorist types who do horrible wicked things like writing books our lords and masters don't like? Okay, a few more surveillance points, a few more hacks into my computer where they find nothing, a few more funny emails and letters from people who are pretty clearly trolling for data. Now that I can handle, but will it escalate? Will it escalate into strange people trying to meet with me in out-of-the-way places, who come to my home and sit on my sofa and try to get me to talk about illegal acts into the microphone? Now, that's happened before. I've always spotted it in time, but by now they have enough of my recorded voice, even if only through these podcasts, so they could assemble some kind of fabricated audio like they did with Ed Steele. Now, if I were to sit here and tell you exactly what I really think about what happened in Paris, would that make some jackass or bitch sitting in an office or a cubicle mad enough so that he or she would scream to their underlings to find some way to put me in prison no matter what it takes? Now, that seems to be what happened to Ed Steele and Bill White and Johnny Logan Spencer and Matt Hale and God knows how many others. Do I really want to take the chance of precipitating that kind of shitstorm at this particular juncture in my career? Am I finally getting cautious in my old age? Well, maybe. But there's another reason that I'm rather leery of stating out loud what I really feel about the events in France. And that is that it's January, it's cold out, I'm becoming a cranky old man, my patience with movement idiocy is wearing as thin as fiddle strings, and I just don't feel like dealing with these goat-dancing morons who, out of whatever bizarre obsession with me motivates them, periodically accuse me of being pro-Muslim. It's utter nonsense, but I just don't feel like dealing with it again right now. But now I've mentioned it, I suppose I have to. Now, my attitude towards Muslims is simple. They should not be here, and we should not be there. The simple fact is that we started it. The United States of America is responsible for dumping millions of ugly, violent, obnoxious European Jews right into the middle of land that had been Muslim for 1,200 years. The United States of America has armed Israel to the teeth and allowed them to murder and oppress millions of Muslims at will over the past 70 years. Now, do you really think that brown though they are, these people don't notice that the bullets being fired into their bodies and the tanks that crush them into the pavement and the electrodes that the Shin Bet wires to their testicles all have Made in America stamped on them? When you drop bombs on people's babies and blow up their weddings with drones and march them through your prisons naked and leashed and invade their countries to steal the one thing they have of any value, then people of any color or religion are going to get pissed off. That little bit of common sense always seems to escape us. Well, they are here now, and if wishes were horses, then beggars would ride, but in this country, as annoying as they are nowhere near as big a problem as niggers and illegal beaners are. Let me say that again. In this country. I understand with great clarity that for our comrades in Europe, the situation is very different, and I accept that they won't agree with a lot of what I say on the subject, which is one reason why I tend to steer clear of it. It's just one of those topics that, when discussed, tends to generate heat rather than light. My main objection to the whole Islamophobia thing is that it tends to let Jews off the hook. No legitimate white nationalist, or decent person for that matter, ever lets Jews off the hook. Remember what the great A.K. Chesterton said, the founder of the Candor League. If they don't name the Jew, their message isn't true. The anti-Muslim thing, especially in Europe, has opened the door to what is known as movement modernization. Again, largely in Europe, of whom the monarch and exemplar is Nick Griffin, formerly of the BNP until finally got his candy ass run out. The basic idea of movement modernization is that we have to accept Jews and queers into our ranks, and especially as leaders, like that faggot Pim Fortuyn in Holland, and that we have to lay off Jews and queers politically and ideologically, because Jews are, quote-unquote, part of the European tradition, which, yeah, I guess they are, a bad part, and because queers are, quote-unquote, irrelevant, and sexuality is a purely private affair and no longer matters in today's wonderful advanced world because we've just gone beyond all that and blah, 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 blah. Now, do I really need to explain to you people why these ideas are so sickening and dangerous and so utterly wrong? Now, if I do, then the movement modernizers have won. They've corrupted you, which shows just how insidious this whole creeping degeneracy is. Never mind. Enough about all this. Here's the trucker.
Westbound and down, 18 wheels are rolling. Are we going to do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound just like a bandit run. Keep your foot hard on the pedal. Son, never mind them brakes. Let it all hang out cause we got to run to make.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from the road again. I'm headed eastbound to New York. I'm heading across Wisconsin right now. It's a little nippy, minus 10. And I have a New Year's resolution for you all and a new 14 words for you to memorize. Okay, the 14 words are shut off your computer, pack your assets, get your ass to the homeland now. Okay, this should be fairly easy, with the exception of those of you in Hawaii or Alaska, but those of you in the continental United States, the lower 48 of the 57 states. Okay, the odd-numbered interstates run north and south. The even-numbered east and west. All right. No matter where you are in the country, this should work, with the exception of, like I said, Alaska and Hawaii. Most of you live east of the homeland, so find an even-numbered interstate near you, be it 10, 20, 30, 40, 70, 80, 90, or 94. Those of you that live south of Interstate 80, which stretches all the way from San Francisco to New York, you just find the interstate that runs east and west. That's the even-numbered ones, like 10, 20, 30, or 70, and head west. And the reason you can tell the east from the west is the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. Plus, they also have these neat little four-letter words along with the interstate that says east or west. So, you head west on the even-numbered interstate, 10, 20, 30, 40, or 70, or 80, until you hit I-25, because that stretches all the way from, Las Cruces, New Mexico, all the way up into Montana. You find I-25 and you head north till you hit I-90, and then you follow that west, and hey, holy crap, you're in the homeland. Pretty easy, huh? And for those of you that live west of I-25, you just go and keep heading west on whichever even-numbered interstate you are until you hit either 15, or if you're west of 15, it would be I-5, and head north, and end up in the homeland. And the reason you know that is because you end up running into I-90. Okay, that should pretty much cover how to get there the easiest way. Or you can open a road atlas and trace out your own route. But I thought I would throw that in there for those of you that are directionally challenged, like my wife, and save you the cost of a few hundred dollars to buy a GPS unit in it, or a smartphone with the GPS already on it. I mean, that's pretty easy, right? Okay. Well, now you've got your New Year's resolution. Get your ass up here. This is the trucker signing off for yet another Tidbits from the Road. Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you. It's the end of 2014, New Year's Eve. How about a new Year's resolution for you? Get your ass up here to the Northwest, to the homeland, by the end of the year. That'd be a novel concept. It's not out of the doable picture if you put your mind to it. And we could use the help and the bodies to offset the local population so we can go and be able to influence elections or just basically influence the at large. Yep, it would be nice to be able to see this long string of U-Hauls headed to the northwest, slowing me down. Gee, that'd be just real tough to take. I don't understand why you are staying where you are, especially if you're in like New York City area where the cops are basically not performing their jobs and stuff because of the conflict between Mayor de Blasio and the police department because of his communistic anti-cop statements and stuff that pissed off the police department. Or those of you that are in the areas where the monkeys are going wild and still protesting the Ferguson bullshit. And I just watched a few YouTube videos of especially the latest one where the monkeys were going wild at McDonald's, beating each other with chairs and all that. Somebody left the cage unlocked and they got out and the primates were going wild. And then we've got the golfer in chief that's occupying our White House. Leaves a lot to be desired. That'd be nice to see him gone one way or the other. But then again, we'd have put up with Shotgun Joe Biden occupying the big seat. I don't know which is worse, Obungo or Shotgun Joe. They're both about as heavy as... No, excuse me, that's insulting a box of rocks. They have more intelligence than both of them put together. But if you were up here in the homeland, we could change all that and not have to put up with their crap. So what's stopping you? There are jobs to be had up here in the homeland. Like I've said before, if you're of the right age and mindset and stuff, you could always go and get employment driving a truck and slowly move your assets up here. And there's plenty of trucking companies based up here in the Northwest where you wouldn't have to leave the Northwest. You could stay up here in the Northwest and just truck the Northwest. We have heavy haul divisions, which once I get my wife gets tired of running team and stuff and wants to stay at home with the grandson and stuff, that's probably what I'll end up doing, is doing heavy haul. That way I can stay out of California and just stay basically in the Northwest area, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, maybe a little Utah or in Nevada and Montana, and possibly Colorado and Wyoming. But I wouldn't have to venture any further or south than that. That would be nice. That way I'm only maybe max couple days from home rather than all the way across the country on the East Coast where it's like a 4 or 5 day run, because the company I drive for is running electronic logs, so you can't really rely on those. We could go and fudge a little bit way back when we still were running paper logs, but D is cracking down on that. So anyways, more on that in another podcast. All right, this is the Trucker signing off for another little Trucker's Rant and Tidbits from the Road. Have a good New Year's, comrades. Make sure you go and make those New Year's resolutions to get your ass up here.
Tell you what, for the first music break, I think I'll go nautical on your ass. A little bit of the old sea chanty here. This is Great Big Sea.
Drunken sailor, what do you do with a drunken sailor? What do you do with a drunken sailor early in the morning? Way, hey, let's rise this way, hey, let's rise this way, hey, let's rise early in the morning.
rusty razor, shave his belly with a rusty razor, lie in the morning.
Way, hey, that's your eyes, is way, hey, that's your eyes, is way, hey, that's your eyes, is early in the morning.
Throw him in the back of the paddy wagon, throw him in the back of the paddy wagon, throw him in the back of the paddy wagon, early in the morning.
Way, hey, that's your eyes, is way, hey, that's your eyes, is way, hey, that's your eyes, is early in the morning.
What do you do with a drunken sailor? What do you do with a drunken sailor? What do you do with a drunken sailor? Early in the morning.
Way, hey, that's your eyes, is way, hey, that's your eyes, is early in the morning.
Throw him in a hole with a captain's daughter, throw him in a hole with a captain's daughter, throw him in a hole with a captain's daughter, early in the morning.
Way, hey, that's your eyes, is way, hey, that's your eyes, is way, hey, that's your eyes, is early in the morning.
Throw him in the lockup till he's sober, throw him in the lockup till he's sober, throw him in the lockup till he's sober.
Sailor, what do you do with a drunken sailor? What do you do with a drunken sailor? Early in the morning. Way, hey, that's your eyes. Way, hey, that's your eyes. Way, hey, that's your eyes.
Drunken sailor, what do you do with a drunken sailor? What do you do with a drunken sailor? Early in the morning.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to discuss Daniel S. Forrest's Superhumanism. Now, this book starts out by saying that Europe is ripe for old-time religion. Now, what the author means by this is that Europeans need a new myth, because while universal Western culture may be the kiss of death, there is a difference between Europe and universalist Western culture, and superhumanism can be the salvation of Europe. Now, if the Church could ever help Europe, it can no longer do so. And this really isn't so surprising, because in Christianity we have a missos that knowledge is the original sin. And Christianity has evolved into various secular doctrines, such as Marxism and other egalitarian philosophies. All of these philosophies, no matter what they are or how they manifest, even if they manifest as contemporary Western democracies, want to take us to the end of history, or we might decide to revive history. Now, this author assumes that when Europeans speak of the survival of humanity, they're really speaking, we're really speaking of ourselves. And what we really need is a collective myth, a story of common Indo-European origins, because in this awareness, we can have a greater sense of three-dimensional history. Now, of course, when you control a notion of the past, you can also use that notion of the past to help shape the present. So, essentially, we have this notion of heroics, and a hero is someone that does not refuse a heroic destiny. Now, the notion of freedom may be relative, but it is also authentic. In a healthy culture, creative types will endorse their culture. But when a culture is sick, a hero will undertake revolution. Now, society is going through changes today, and these changes are of a very great magnitude. In their significance, they are just as strong as when hunter-gatherers changed to agriculture. Today, we understand much, and we can decide what we will become, even biologically. Western society has always been one that takes full charge of itself, but yet there's also a counter-energy, and that is egalitarianism. This author sees that counter-energy of egalitarianism as really stemming from the Judaic tradition, and this has really been with us since the beginning of the Neolithic. Indo-European culture tends to be a shame and glory culture and not a guilt culture. And the notion of God is implicit in nature, and humans may even become gods. Whereas in the notion of Christ, we essentially have an anti-hero who will glorify other anti-heroes. But the pagan consciousness has always been this heretical trend. Now, if we lack a collective vision, we may end up being controlled by technology, because we will not be grounded without a founding myth. The author reminds us that institutions such as the church tend to be allergic to the will to power, and they tend to oppose eugenics. And this type of thinking could hold us back. Of course, the author also mentions that this is a power that could fall into the wrong hands. And also, of course, people such as the Chinese will not hesitate to use eugenics. Now, there are others that may pick a less dangerous trend, and they may simply choose a path of degrowth, a back-to-nature idea. While superhumanism does support a certain amount of degrowth, it also supports sustainable development, and it really believes that human destiny is to take even greater domination of the earth. In this view, liberty is political and not moral. Nietzsche declares that if one is free, then one will be a warrior. Right now, Europe has no project of sovereignty, and so, in a sense, is dead. According to this author, neither former Soviets nor Americans will ever be Rome. They will never form an imperium. Contrary to popular opinion, this author feels that really our hope should be that Europe will find some way to rise out of its lack of sovereignty, and that it will form a global community of people of European descent. Now, some may say that superhumanism is some form of irrationalism, but it is not irrational. And this author affirms that both Nietzsche and Wagner are two ends of the spectrum of superhumanism. Now, this author goes into the history of Nietzsche and Wagner and talks about how Nietzsche was really jealous of Wagner for both professional and personal reasons, although I think it can be agreed that Nietzsche was the more thorough philosopher. However, because Wagner appealed to emotion, he is more feared than Nietzsche. When we look at Wagner's conception of the Superman, which is also spoken of in Nietzsche, this author tells us that Odin is really this notion of, I would almost prefer to say that the supreme man, because he has this knowledge, this all-encompassing knowledge. The term Superman kind of bothers me because it makes me think of a comic book. I think there are some who would look at the ring cycle and believe that this favored man, or whatever you want to call him, is Siegfried, but I really think that there is a correctness in saying that it is Odin. Now, this author talks about how fascism is one offshoot of superhumanism, but says that it was immature and premature. Now, I don't know if this is a PC application or a legitimate critique of a geopolitical movement, but I'm not sure who this author thinks is going to be promulgating superhumanism, if not the quote-unquote far right. But the author reminds us that superhumanism is not necessarily left or right. At first, this notion of the new right was actually called the new culture, and the book finishes by noting that this struggle is a gift. Now, I found that there were some repetitions in this book, but I think it shows in very stark contrast the sort of choice that we face right now. It also really reminds us of just the extreme technological advances and various things that are happening, even with biological engineering, that are really just quite mind-blowing in today's world. Of course, it also reminds us of the very important goings-on within German philosophy that were sort of a foretaste, or hopefully a foretaste, of how European society ought to be moving forward. But I'm always amazed at how, even though I should of course know this, how today's thinking is often so far removed from where it should be. So this is a book that is available on Kindle. I found it on Amazon, and it appears that no one has even surprisingly reviewed it yet, and yet it seems such an important, or hitting the nail right on the head in so many ways. So this is a book that you may want to read, and it's sort of I would call it a medium-sized book, and it's not a quick read, and neither is it particularly slow. So at any rate, thank you for listening, and hail victory, comrades.
My name is Edgar J. Steele. It's April 17, 2008, and today's piece is entitled In Defense of Anti-Semitism, Reloaded. I really need to update and reissue more of my older pieces than I've been doing. Readers often point out something I wrote years ago, causing me to ferret it out of my archives myself and read it again with fresh eyes, as though reading somebody else's work for the first time. If it seems fresh and worthwhile to me, I figure, it'll be even fresher to those who never had a chance to read it in the first place. Besides, it amazes me how well so much has stood up over time. Take today's piece, which I wrote over 5 years ago, just before America lurched into Iraq. Our posture was much as it is today, on the verge of shelling Iran. I was tempted to update this article completely, but resisted that urge. There's a good deal to be learned from a historical perspective, even one so recent as exhibited herein. Perhaps this will do some good regarding our impending misadventure in Iran. Listen with me now as I hold forth, yet again, on the root cause of American problems. Originally, I wanted to call this Why I Am an Anti-Semite. It's telling indeed that even I finally knuckled under and chose a less sensational title. The silence in America concerning Jews is simply deafening, isn't it? The old adage has it that when visiting a foreign country to ascertain who really runs things, one need determine only who is spoken about in whispers, if at all. Never unwilling to offend, I would like to talk about Jews today, and not in whispers either. This piece will be longer than most I write, even though I will only be skimming the field. A good deal of ground must be covered, else the true picture does not emerge. What gets lost in all the saber-rattling and bellicosity concerning Iraq is the why of the impending war. Because the Iraqis hate our freedom? No, obviously not. Because they are too evil to exist? Come on. Because they have used awful weapons, still possess them, and will use them again? Give me a break. On the basis of that rationale, we should be marching on every member of NATO. The Muslims are right, you know. This is a war against Islam. Pure and simple. Not Christianity versus Islam. Not the West versus Islam. Not America versus Islam. This is a war between Judaism and Islam. Palestine writ large. Not a religious war either, despite the rhetoric of the Arabs. It is a racial war, and Americans are the cannon fodder. But Israel is our friend, you say. The best friend we have in that hostile quarter of the world. Our only friend, more like it. Israel is our friend so long as we serve its purposes. Indeed, friend is too kind a word. Svengali is more like it. Proof abounds of Israel acting against America's interests at every turn, many of which we will review today. No, Israel does not run America, but the shadowy cartel that does run America is solidly behind Israel. Israel is that cartel's mistress. America, its dowdy wife. No, not every member of that cartel is Jewish, but so many are that it might as well be exclusive. There was a time in the not-too-distant past when I thought that Jewishness was religious and cultural, possibly racial too, but so what? After all, American Jews are generally well-off, well-educated, well-spoken, a little clannish, and well-connected. Just like you and me, only better dressed and with trust funds. Like rich Mormons, maybe. It's an outlook shared by most Americans. It is wrong. This common misperception will prove fatal to America, just as it has to so many nations down through time. This is where I'm supposed to utter the obligatory, "I'm not anti-Semitic, I'm really just anti-Zionist." Well, that's a cop-out, and I refuse to do it, even though strictly true. I'm appalled that all Jews allow the Zionists among them to fall back into their ranks, hiding behind their Jewishness, while hurling charges of anti-Semitism at those they dislike. And their fellow Jews don't say a word about it. In the law, we call that a conspiracy, and we lock up the co-conspirators just like the perps. Okay, I'll play. I'm anti-Semitic. So what? Do you really blame me after all that you have done to me, my family, and my country? Nay, the world. Let's get the term straight. Joe Sabran really is right on the money regarding anti-Semite, first of all, when he says that it used to be defined as being somebody who hates Jews, but now it means a man who is hated by Jews. Ultimately, an anti-Semite is whatever a Jew says, whoever a Jew dislikes. And, ultimately, Jews seem to dislike everybody else. In fact, I've seen Jews acknowledge that everybody who isn't a Jew is, by definition, anti-Semitic. Kind of like the rationale underlying hate crime laws, which are only applied against white people because all white people are deemed racist, per se. Jew. It's a race, not a religion. Facts are facts. The majority of Israelis are atheist. At this moment, Jews are doggedly trying to craft a deadly virus that will select people, such as Arabs, for their DNA differences from Jewish DNA. And I don't want to hear all this buzz about Khazar versus Sephardic Jews or who deserves to claim to be descended from the biblical family of Abraham. There is a group of people scattered throughout the world that calls itself Jewish. We all know who they are. Just as do they. They are racially identifiable, even if of two or three flavors. They get the label Jew, and that is reality, history aside. Zionist used to mean those who worked toward the establishment of a Jewish homeland. Now it means Jewish supremacist, pure and simple, kind of like white supremacist, only kosher. Zionists are the real problem, and they are found among the ranks of Jews everywhere. They are the ones that always cross the line and get the whole lot of them thrown out of the country. You don't believe this? Okay, then you offer a single logical reason why it has happened time and again in all the European countries. Zionism is racism of the first order. Yes, Jews do get persecuted. What gets overlooked is the reason. kind of like focusing on the rights of the murderer and not his victim. No, not kind of. That's exactly what it is.
Oi! Foist Egypt, den Germany! Out here! What? Why are they persecuting us so?
Trust me, they know precisely why. Generally, it appears to me that someone has to have had a trigger event of some sort happen to themselves or someone close to them before that person is willing to see Jews as predatory. A trigger event wherein a Jew played the role of the victimizer. Like how being raped will make any woman a rabid defender of the Second Amendment. Without a trigger event, people generally are willing to dismiss those who speak out as being nut, racist, and white supremacists, like saying the raped woman was asking for it. That's how that treatment feels, believe me. My trigger event actually was two. First, when a lawyer that I hired, hoping that he would work hard and eventually take over my thriving San Francisco law practice, allowing me to retire, tried to steal all my firm's clients, work in progress, and employees, leaving me with nothing. This after only a couple months on the job, too. Jewish, of course. Most lawyers are, you know. Though the sledding was tough with this guy due to the Jewish judges, eventually I eviscerated him financially, and with the help of a black judge at that. Second, and this was the really key event for me, when my children received death threats from a Jewish telephone caller, merely because I had dared to represent Richard Butler and the Aryan Nations against a set of false charges. There have been lots of other events since then, but I will never forget the look in my little girl's tear-filled eyes as she told me about the woman who was going to kill her. Watching one's family butchered will make a terrorist of anyone. Just ask the Palestinians. Similarly, watching your family terrorized by Zionists will make you anti-Semitic in a heartbeat. Take it from me.
This is a German national anarchist group. Not totally sure what that is. The group is called Triari, and the song is called Europa. Right. Getting back to what I was saying last week about the T-shirt youth, let's do a quick recap. First off, I was talking about the way in which white nationalist grouplets actually function in the real world, insofar as they do function at all in the real world, which isn't very far. I'd say that at least 90% of white nationalism and separatism today consists of nothing but internet. Secondly, all of this is purely theoretical discussion because we have no money, and the few bodies that the NF does have on the ground are all occupied in making a living. We do not have the kind of professionalized party that is capable of actually implementing this yet. And we won't until somehow I can begin the process of changing your character first, and then white racial character as a whole. I'm referring here to the last vestiges of physical activity carried out by what used to be loosely referred to as the movement, which, let me hasten to add, does not just mean the Northwest Front, but every group that I've been involved in or have been able to observe over the past 43 years. Basically, guys, this is the template that we have to change completely, and we do it through changing our own inner character. Now, in your typical white nationalist outfit of any kind, NS, Klan, what have you, you got a fearless leader who was assisted by a small core of active people who will actually do things out in the physical world, which usually means showing up and standing on a street corner holding a sign, sometimes wearing a costume and allowing left-wing and non-white scum to throw things at him. But it can also mean showing up at meetings in restaurants and public parks, since most people are scared to use their homes for meetings, doing some actual physical literature distribution, somebody who's actually willing to do some long-distance driving for the cause in his own car, maybe even let you use his garage as a meeting place if he has one, since nobody actually has any buildings anymore, etc., etc. Basically, this small active group will do things which carry at least some risk of public exposure. In the past, this function usually involved putting on a costume or a robe and being seen in public wearing it. Every now and then, one of these actives will run for public office as a publicity stunt with no campaign and all of $100 in the bank, but that's usually reserved for fearless leader himself who wants to hog all the publicity. Now, that's your fearless leader's active core, usually 6 or 7 guys, sometimes a few more. We have never had a genuine mass movement since the end of World War II, when the Jews got sufficiently powerful to impose what they refer to as economic discipline on white dissidents, which translates into, step out of line and we will take your stuff. And when you threaten an American's stuff, he folds like a lawn chair. The active section of any white nationalist group almost always consists of young to middle-aged single and divorced men who have either already lost everything that they had to America or else they never had anything to lose to begin with. They have no stuff for the Jews to threaten and therefore aren't afraid of losing it. They are marginally employed, probably at minimum wage or only a little higher, and so they pretty closely approach being financially bulletproof, which is an absolute necessity if anyone is going to engage in serious white dissent in this society. Now, these days, we refer to these people as the T-shirt youth, rootless and mostly unskilled young white men with nothing but the T-shirts on their backs and $20 in their pocket. Many of them are still living in their mother's basements at age 25 or 26 or more, sometimes delivering pizzas or doing other odd jobs. To some degree, their situation is their own fault, but to a large degree it isn't. They dicked off in school because they saw the niggers getting away with it, and also because American public schools are no longer functional as educational institutions, and there was nothing to learn there. American public high schools have now become such horrific places that avoiding them has become a matter of survival, almost. There are some occasional exceptions, but it's almost always the damaged and embittered young men with no realistic hope of careers or marriage or families who put on the costumes and go out in public because they know that America has thrown them away and they no longer give a damn. This takes us to the second echelon of all white nationalist groups. The middle class, comparatively affluent and well-educated and well-employed supporters, whom all groups rely on for financial support, since almost none of our groups down through history have ever managed to set up any kind of efficient and functioning system of collecting dues. Now look at our own 10x1000 program. We could be stirring an actual revolution here in the Northwest right now if I could just get you people to actually, for real, kick in that monthly sawbuck. Anyhow, the result is that white nationalist groups are almost always dependent on free will impulse donations, conscience money from conscience-stricken middle-class white men who feel very bad about themselves. Now, they know that they should be actually fighting, actually resisting this tyranny. I mean, really fighting. But they're too timid and frightened to do so. They're also disorganized and cut off from every other form of human support. They're afraid of the FBI. They're afraid the little woman might leave them and take the kids and then send lawyers to take his stuff. They're afraid of what the neighbors would say. They're afraid of loss of job, which means loss of stuff, basically. And they think more of their stuff than they do of their race. They know that this is wrong and despicable, and they hate themselves for it. So they send groups like ours conscience money. Hey, I'm not knocking it. Conscience money is what keeps me out from under the bridge at night. Now, this is one reason why these people seem to have a kind of shelf life per group. They keep moving from group to group looking for that one fearless leader who may, for real, turn out to be the man on the white horse. Now, I could have been at one time, maybe even I still can be, but I can't attract enough of you so we could ever find out. They are looking for white strength. They are looking for a crowd to hide in, to buck up their courage and stiffen their spines so that these pale middle-class wimps can finally stand up and hold up their heads and be brave. And to give them due credit, most of them probably could be brave and show courage and determination, and they could become useful participants in actual revolutionary politics if they can ever find that all-important crowd to hide in and to give them a support system. Now, we gabble a lot about lone wolves in our wee little movement, and we've been doing that for years, but have you noticed that we don't seem to have actually produced very many of them at all? Genuine lone wolves who can live all alone in the forest and survive in the Zionist wilderness are very rare indeed. I did it for many years, and I know some others, but they're all of my generation, and we come from a time when young white males were able to learn the old ways and the old character values from actual parents who were more or less uncorrupted, or in my case, my grandfather. And we have the moral reinforcement of remembering an all-white world, which is something these younger people have never seen. Guys, never believe that I am blaming young white people for what they are. They are victims. They have been deliberately made that way by the Jews and the lefty libs. American white people are herd animals. They are socially engineered that way, and the only way to get them politically functional is to either give them an alternate herd to hide in, or else develop a workaround that fakes the herd responses in their brains. And I'm babbling again. Sorry. Tell you what, let's do third music break. This is Mike Cross.
I just got back from the frozen Midwest. Step out of the taxi cab at the airport up there in Minnesota. Said about two sentences. Folks saw the grits flying out of my mouth. They said, you're not from around here, are you?
No, I'm not.
Where are you from?
Well, I'm from down western North Carolina, back in the Appalachian Mountains.
All right. I know where that is. It's where all that moonshining and inbreeding goes on, isn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, how about singing this little song about moonshine?
I don't sing about sacred subjects. Tell you what I'll do, though. Sing you a song about that other half of the culture. That's the inbreeding portion.
Always like to do this song early on. Elma Turtle is a beautiful girl. I'd love to have her for my wife. She's just the kind of a woman who can make me happy for the rest of my life. But my daddy said, son, there's something you don't know. It's something I think you ought to. Now, Elma Turtle is a beautiful girl, but son, she's my daughter. Whoops. Well, Alice Green is a beautiful thing. I'd love to have her for my wife. And she's just the kind of a woman who could make me happy for the rest of my life. But my daddy said, son, there's something you don't know. It's something I think you ought to. Now, Alice Green is a beautiful thing, but son, she's my daughter.
No laziness or hookworm in my family.
I've been all around the whole darn county like a buck hunting for a doe. But it seems every girl I'd like to marry is a wild oat daddy sowed. So I went to my mama with my head hung down, and she asked me what the matter could be. I told her my problem, and she took my hand and said, "Son, now listen to me. You see, your daddy was such a good-looking young man, and like an eager young stallion horse, his blood ran hot, so you can't blame him for letting Mother Nature take her course. But you got no reason to be upset. Don't you worry, don't fret, don't bother. You see, your daddy ain't your daddy, though he thinks he is, so you can marry whoever you want."
Okay, let me finally get down to the nitty-gritty. I'm sorry about all the build-up, but it was necessary because this is another one of those things that if I just sprung it on you guys without any prep, it would have been completely distorted and misinterpreted, and I figure it's best to do as much of the explaining as possible beforehand rather than after. Okay, here's the problem. We've got the optimates on the one hand, the so-called good people, the educated, more or less affluent by our standards, the technically and socially skilled, the well-placed, the people who, if they chose to make a full life commitment to the Northwest Republic in money and in themselves, could give us that republic and pretty quick, too. Just a few thousand of these optimates making a full life commitment would do it. The Bolsheviks had around 7,000 party members in 1917 when they overthrew the Tsar and the Russian Empire. We just want 3.5 states. But the optimates won't do it. They won't commit. They're too shit scared of what people will say. They're too shit scared that they will lose their stuff. They half-step. They dabble. They get spooked at the first sign of trouble, the first knock on the door and the first flip of a badge. And they run away and hide. They deny me 3 times before the cock crows and scream for me to take them off the list and never contact them again, so forth and so on. Now, potentially, they are the most vitally important group we need. In actual practice, as a group, they are useless except for the admittedly vital function which they do fulfill of kicking in just enough money to keep us limping on from month to month and crisis to crisis. Above all, they refuse to come home here to the Pacific Northwest where the hell they're supposed to be. Now, let's get something clear. Please be aware, there are a few noble and admirable exceptions to this, and they are duly acknowledged and deeply appreciated, more than I can say. These exceptions are the ones who give me hope. Now, on the other hand, we have the T-shirt youth, the young men and now some young women as well, with nothing but the T-shirts on their backs and $20 in their pocket. Mostly young, although now unfortunately aging, as this wretched country and the Obama Depression rolls on. Now, most of them are poorly educated and unskilled, because for whatever reason they flubbed high school and missed out on college, or else they flubbed that too. Most, but not all of them, are marginally employed or unemployed. Many of them are still living with their parents, or flopping on friends' couches, or living in actual homeless shelters. Many of them have mental and emotional problems, and a lot of them have substance abuse problems. They are the last full generation of white people on the North American continent. They have been thrown away by America, they know it, and they hate what America has done to them. They act out and lash out, usually through self-destructive behaviors, but sometimes in a quasi-racial neo-political manner when they pick up a semi-auto and walk into a shopping mall or a former workplace, looking for black or brown faces to smash. A huge proportion of these T-shirt youth are useless. They are simply too badly damaged. And a large part of the movement's problems down through the decades has been the result of our trying to get mileage out of them. But that may be what we have to start trying to do once again, because you see, there are two things about the T-shirt youth which make them players in all this. First off, thanks to Barack Obama, there are millions of them now living in anger and despair and without hope. And secondly, because they are living in anger and despair and without hope, and they have nothing to lose, they will actually come here, whereas the timid and frightened middle-class conscience donors will not. It is the modern version of the old problem our movement has always had. The good ones will not fully commit. They dabble, and they half-step. And so we, who are still sincerely trying, have to make do with what we can get. Therein lies the cause of so many of our problems. Okay, the T-shirt youth usually demand to be given things in order to come here, like paid transportation and free housing and a refrigerator full of beer, which was pretty much the draw at Aryan Nations and led to all kinds of problems. But suppose we can figure out a workaround for those problems, as we will have to figure out workarounds for so many other things to make up for the fact that we don't actually have any money, but we have to present as if we do. Suppose we can find some way to start bringing the T-shirt youth and all their many variations here to the homeland and start filling up the street corners in Seattle and Portland and Spokane with groups of angry and unemployed young men, white men who are racially aware. Now, it will require something of a change of emphasis for the NF, but given the high level of internet access among young white people today, we do, in fact, have a mass medium of communication available if we can ever get anybody to just look at it. Now, it could be done, and we could at long last at least get some actual physical bodies up here, then start sorting through them and seeing who among them is in fact worth a bucket of warm spit, and who among them are just simply too badly damaged by America to be of any use. Yeah, I know, it's not the way I wanted to do this, as witness the fact that I have spent the past 12 years trying to motivate the Optimates first. But at this rate, our window of opportunity is going to fly by and be gone before we are anywhere near ready, and that's not an option. Okay, let's chew this over some more in coming episodes, but for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.
Well, they fought for poor old Ireland, and so bitter was their fate. Oh, what glory!